Building Voices, the CMS podcast series focusing on dispute management and resolution in the construction and infrastructure industries. My name's Emma Hutchinson, and I'm a senior associate in the Infrastructure, Construction and Energy Disputes team in the CMS Sheffield office. This episode's topic of conversation is reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete, or RAC for short. Concerns around RAC have become increasingly widespread since the Department for Education issued guidance on the materials management in the context of school buildings earlier this year. And as a result of the guidance, and as I'm sure you're all well aware now, schools across the UK known to contain RAC have closed, and alternative venues were sought to commence the autumn school term. Problems associated with RAC are not, however, exclusive to the public sector. RAC was commonly used for the construction of roof decks, walls and floor reconstructions across a broad spectrum of properties in post-war Britain from the 1950s to the 1990s, and has been identified in other publicly accessed properties as well as private property. With a lifespan of 30 years, the last known RAC produced in the UK is now beyond its design life expectancy. Exposure to moisture over the years, particularly in the context of the UK's increasingly wet climate, will mean that RAC is more at risk to deterioration and failure. To discuss how issues surrounding RAC are impacting our clients, I'm joined today by a number of my colleagues from across the UK. Amy Farmer, who's a senior associate in the Environment, Health and Safety team based in our Sheffield and Manchester offices. Gregor Woods, who's a partner in our insurance and reinsurance group based in Sheffield. And Ellie Black, who's a senior associate in our real estate disputes team based in London. Hi all. Amy, turning to you first, is there a statutory framework which governs who is responsible for RAC from a health and safety perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. All employers owe duties under the Health and Safety at Work Act. So under Section 2 and 3 of that Act, they're required to ensure, so far as reasonably practicable, the health, safety and welfare of their employees at work, as well as those people who are not directly in their employment, but who may be affected by their undertaking, for example, any visitors to the premises. And then under Section 4, then in respect of premises made available as a place of work, each person who has, to any extent, control of the premises is obligated to take such measures as is reasonable for a person in their position to take to ensure, as far as reasonably practicable, the premises are safe and without risk to health of non-employees.
Okay, so the issue seems to be who has control over the premises. So how do you know if you have control over the premises?
Yeah, so the Act sets out that a person is defined as having control where under a contract or tenancy, an obligation exists on a party in relation to the maintenance or repair of any premises. It's therefore essential to consider the terms of any contract or lease in respect of repair and maintenance obligations to establish which entities in the leaseholder chain may have control of the premises for the purposes of the Act. And it's thought this is going to be, especially under the current climate, defined very widely.
So what are the consequences of breaching the statutory health and safety obligations?
So punitive sanctions exist under the Health and Safety at Work Act. Crucially, criminal liability can be incurred and a breach of statutory health and safety obligations can lead to a prosecution with a conviction resulting in up to an unlimited fine and or imprisonment.
Right. Thanks, Amy. So clearly this isn't something that can be ignored and it's important to establish early on who's responsible. On that note, Ellie, turning to you, what's this going to mean for landlords and tenants? Who holds responsibility in that relationship?
So the starting point would be having a look at the repair and maintenance clauses under the lease and any other kind of contracts that are in place between the parties to establish who's got responsibility, the repair and maintenance of the parts of the building which contain RAC panels. You might find that both landlords and tenants have repairing obligations that overlap, or that there might be other lease covenants which put the onus on them to act. So it's not just going to be limited to those repair and maintenance clauses. But even where a landlord's pretty confident that their tenant has the repair or other obligation to look after the parts of the premises which contain RAC, the position isn't clear cut. We can't just go to the repair covenants and leave it there. Landlords can still be at risk. So, for example, landlords that have sufficient knowledge of a risk and have rights to go into a premises under their lease. So, for example, if a lease allows a landlord to enter the premises to remedy a tenant's breach at the tenant's cost, the landlord might still be at risk of liability under the Health and Safety at Work Act or the Defective Premises Act 1972 if they don't actually take the steps necessary in those circumstances where they're presented with a risk, so a tenant's failure to repair or take any action. Given the likely costs that are going to be involved, tenants may well dispute liability under their leases. They don't want to have to absorb the cost or be responsible for the repairs. The range of the kind of arguments that they could raise on those points are quite varied. You know, so is rack disrepair? Are there exclusions for liability for inherent defects? And so that's a defect in the design or construction of a building or the materials that were used in its construction.
Great, thanks, Ellie. So turning to you now, Greg. What if the worst case scenario actually materialises and a collapse of rack panels happens? What types of liability could those responsible face?
Hi, well, in addition to the potential criminal liability that Amy talked about, those with responsibility may well be sued for damages by an individual or individuals injured because of a collapse, or even worse, if there's a fatality by the estate or dependents of the person killed as a consequence of a collapse. I think it's really important that we remember the context here and why we're talking about RAC now. We're talking about RAC because of a gathering storm of concern about it. And in 2018, of course, we had the collapse of a ceiling in the staff room at Singlewell Primary School. And that was a lucky escape by the sounds of it. It happened at the weekend and there was no one present, so no one was injured. And there'd been a previous collapse in a school in Edinburgh in 2016. Clearly, there is a risk. There's a risk that this material, which is used as a structural material, could collapse and may cause injury or death. So that's the context that we're talking about this in. Now, were that to happen, and those with a relevant responsibility, a duty of care to the person injured, could clearly face a civil claim for damages, in addition to any potential prosecution and associated reputational damage. So if we think about those who might be subject to such claims, one thinks of some certain obvious categories, I guess. So employers who owe a statutory and common law duty to employees and those affected by their businesses to take reasonable care for their safety. Occupiers, we've heard about, those with control of premises who owe a duty of care towards visitors to the premises, a duty to take reasonable care. And landlords with an obligation under the tenancy agreement for maintenance and repair of premises. They too owe a duty to all people who might reasonably be expected to be affected by defects in the state of the premises, a duty to take such care as is reasonable to keep them safe from injury. So any one of those categories of party, of body, could be faced with a claim and ultimately in order to pay damages if it could be shown on the balance of probabilities that they failed to behave reasonably in response to the perceived risk posed by RAC. The damages that they could be ordered to pay would reflect the gravity of the injuries sustained and all consequential financial losses suffered by the claimant as a consequence of the injury. So that broadly is the context that we're speaking in and the potential risk in terms of civil claims against responsible parties.
Thanks, Greg. So a lot of the duties that you've just set out are couched in terms of what is reasonable. So, for example, taking all reasonable steps or seeing that people are reasonably safe. Do you have a view as to what reasonable means in this context? And Amy, Ellie, please feel free to jump on this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably worth starting with employers. We have this concept in law, the reasonable employer. So when we ask, what should an employer do? What would be reasonable care, constitute reasonable care? It is what is this the standard of care of the reasonable employer? What would we expect of a reasonable employer? So when assessing whether the duty of care has been breached, the question is, what would a reasonable employer do? Having regard to the likelihood of the risk materialising, the gravity of the harm, if it does, and what practical steps are available to mitigate the risk. And a reasonable employer, the courts have found, is one who keeps abreast of developing knowledge and adjusts its approach accordingly. You know, with all these categories of party, employers, occupiers, landlords, we're asking a very similar question. In light of what we now know, what steps would be reasonable? So what do we now know? We know that RAC concrete is thought to have a 30-year lifespan, so all of it is past its estimated lifespan, but it may be rather shorter in particular buildings, depending on how it was fitted and ingress of water and all of those things that may have adjusted its lifespan. We know it was used as a structural material across a wide range of buildings for over a 40-year period from the mid-1950s. And crucially, I think we know it can give way with little or no warning. And then the understanding of that, the appreciation of that is, I think, has really changed the game in relation to risk management. Depending on its particular location, the consequence of it giving way could, of course, be catastrophic. So when we're thinking about the magnitude of the risk, the magnitude potentially is very, very high indeed. It could cause injury or death. And if you look at the HSE website, in August this year, they issued advice about RAC, which said RAC is now life expired. It is liable to collapse with little or no notice. So when we're considering what steps would be reasonable, that's the context that we're considering, you know, reasonable steps in. So I think the first thing you would do, the first reasonable step, is to find out if you actually have RAC in the premises you're responsible for. You may know that. You may know it certainly can't have RAC because of its age. You may well not be sure. So I think then you're looking at bringing in professionals, a chartered surveyor or a chartered structural engineer to assess whether RAC is present. And if it is, again, I think you're looking for expert advice. How do we manage the risk given where it is and given its condition? So those steps, I think, are what would be deemed, you know, reasonable in all of those three contexts. Take advice, you know, find out if you've got it. If you have, take professional advice on how to mitigate the risk posed by it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's the point in terms of, from a health and safety perspective, that you would want to get an expert in to do that risk assessment that Greg sort of talked about, is identifying the risk, the likelihood of it occurring, what harm might come from it, and therefore what are those reasonably practicable steps. And depending on the outcome of that, you know, it appears at the moment a lot of it is people sort of ensuring that they don't have access to those areas, but there could be other steps. Again, it's not a one size fits all. It's making sure that you look at the specifics of your building and ensuring that you come up with that risk assessment undertaken by health and safety experts, and other experts may need to feed into that, as Greg's already noted.
I think just kind of build on what I said earlier, from a property point of view, I think it's really key that landlords and tenants are reviewing their leases carefully to establish who in the first instance is required to take action, what that action might be, and in what circumstances they have to do so. But then, you know, if the responsible party isn't taking the steps necessary to remedy the RAC, what rights does the lease give you to go in and undertake the necessary repairs? As Greg says, given what we know about RAC, its lifespan and the risks posed, positive actions almost certainly going to be required where you know about the presence of RAC and have identified the risk, whether or not you have the strict liability for that under your lease.
And I think in terms of control, just to sort of round that off around the section four, is there's sort of two elements of the reasonableness. In terms of the first part is take such measures as is reasonable for a person in their position. So that's the sort of subjective part. What under the lease can that person actually do? What have they got the right or ability to do? And then look at what is reasonably practicable in terms of what steps are reasonably practicable to take. So it's sort of a two-part reasonable test for the part four.
Okay, thanks everyone. One thing that strikes me is that all of those suggestions sound quite expensive and potentially quite burdensome for the person that's responsible. So who is responsible for the costs of dealing with RAC when it's discovered?
Good question. And we think it's sadly an area that's going to be ripe for disputes, because both landlords and tenant are going to want to look to avoid the cost of the carrying out the repair works. In cases where landlords have the primary lease obligation to act, so they have the repair obligations and were going in and undertaking the works themselves, they'll be looking to recover the cost of doing so via the service charge. And again, it's necessary to go through the service charge provisions with a fine-tooth comb to see whether there are any carve-outs which exist, which might enable the tenant to avoid contributing towards those costs. So again, there might be a carve-out for the cost of repairing any inherent defects. But yeah, there's no one size fits all when it comes to lease. It's very much going to come down to its drafting.
And outside of this, that particular context of leaseholds, landlords and tenants, it's the party with the duty, with the obligation. And so the cost of remedial works is one of the factors that you consider when you're considering, well, what would be a reasonably practicable step. You think about cost, you think about practicability, and you think about the potential risk. How likely is it? And if it does eventuate, what's the magnitude of it? So these are all factors that one would consider when determining what would be a reasonable step to take. And all factors, of course, that a court would consider if there was a collapse and a claim was brought. Did you not take steps because you decided it was too expensive? Well, let's look at the reasonableness in the context of the nature of the risk. That's the kind of analysis that a court would undertake.
Thanks, everyone. So in summary, given the high profile of the RAP crisis, it's going to be really difficult for responsible parties to argue now that they're not reasonably aware of the risks of RAP. The key takeaway from everything you've been saying to me today seems to be that now is the time for those with responsibility for building maintenance to ensure they know whether their premises contain RAC, and then to take reasonable steps to assess the risk of collapse and seek professional advice as necessary. Thank you very much, Amy, Greg and Ellie, for your valuable insight into this interesting topic. And of course, thank you to everyone for listening. We look forward to welcoming you next time. This was Building Voices.